everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food on a very, very snowy white January 21st, 2014. I hope you're warm and comfortable wherever you are. Maybe in some places you're a little too warm or maybe a little too dry. The weather is weather everywhere. And do we have any contribution to the way our climate reacts? We're going to talk more about that in the second part of the show, but right now I'm enjoying looking at the snow falling. I'm glad I'm inside, but it's really something else to watch. All right, let's move on to my very first guest. I'm very excited to have Robin Lamont on the program today. She worked as a Broadway actress and singer, playing lead roles in Godspell, Grease, and Working. Her original cast recording of Day by Day and her film version of that song have drawn fans from around the world. Utilizing her acting experience, she became an undercover investigator for a firm in New York City that specialized in investigations into counterfeiting. During that time, she went to law school and later practiced as an assistant district attorney in New York. Wait, there's more. More recently, while continuing her writing, Robin volunteers for animal welfare organizations trying to raise awareness about the plight of animals throughout the world. She has a website, animalsuspense.com, and we're going to be talking about her new book, The Chain. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Karen. How are you?
Okay, you are one spectacular Renaissance woman, aren't you?
Well, it has been a variety of careers, I do admit.
Yeah, that sounds like a charmed life.
I don't know if it's charmed. You know, one thing kind of led to the other, but I hope I'm well settled in my last career.
Yeah, well, we need you here, and let's talk about this book you wrote, The Chain. So this is a thriller, a suspense novel about a slaughterhouse corporation in North Carolina.
Yes, that's right. You know, a few years ago, I became interested in where my food came from, one of those people.
Congratulations. Thank you. We appreciate that.
Thank you. I'm very happy I got to that place. I began to read about factory farms and meatpacking plants, and then I kind of broadened my investigation into the plight of many animals and how they're treated, whether it's puppy mills, dogs raised for fighting, circuses, the indiscriminate trapping, hunting of wildlife. And what I saw was so disturbing, and revealed how much of the abuse of animals is really hidden from view. I honestly believe that if most people knew about it, they wouldn't tolerate the cruelty.
I would like to believe that.
I kind of do. Anyway, as a suspense novelist, I started to look at the real-life investigators and talk to them, and the real investigators who were working to expose the cruelty. And I thought that maybe the time had come to create that kind of character in mainstream fiction. You know, in suspense and the mystery genre, there's certainly no shortage of detectives and lawyers who seek justice for people. I thought, how about animals?
Yeah. In some ways, it reminds me of Upton Sinclair's story, The Jungle. And I could only hope that it would have the impact that that book had decades ago.
Oh, indeed. It had enormous impact. You know, I hope so, too. I think right now the book is being well-received by a lot of animal advocates. But there are a lot of people who are reading it who have come back to me and said, you know, this is making me rethink my meat.
Mm.
And that's incredibly gratifying.
Mm-hmm. Now, people realize this is a fictional story, but a fictional story based on truth. And my question is, how much truth is in this book? Because it's pretty scary.
It is pretty scary. Unfortunately, I think there is a lot of truth in many of the scenes. The characters are fictional, but what's happening to animals in the slaughterhouse is unfortunately very real. To do research on the book, I not only spoke to a number of undercover investigators who've been inside, But I went and I met with Gail Eisnitz, the author of Slaughterhouse.
Mm.
And we spent a fantastic weekend down in North Carolina together. And she helped me to really understand, and I looked at a lot of videos. It's very real what's happening there.
Well, this took place in North Carolina, and I remember learning about everything that goes on there. There's a big pork industry in North Carolina, and I'm not sure most people are aware of this vertical industry of livestock where some people raise the animal and then other people kill the animal. It doesn't all happen in the same place.
Absolutely. I mean, that's so true.
And there's actually a corporation that does the slaughtering separate from everything else. It's a business.
It's absolutely a business, and it is, you know, an incredible vertical business, and there's a great deal of money involved, you know. And what I tried to capture in this particular book was not just that the animals are being abused in these massive slaughterhouses on meatpacking plants, but the workers are being exposed to a lot of danger and a lot of unhealthy conditions in addition.
Yeah, this is, I think, the worst industry for accidents to humans in industry.
I think you're absolutely right. My understanding is the highest rate of injury and illness in any manufacturing sector.
It's kind of a classic theme where the big rich guy is the bad guy who has power over everything, whether it be a corporation or government or anything like that. And then it's the little people who are frightened and they're possibly not doing what they really believe in, but they don't see an opportunity to do anything else. And then we have the wonderful heroine who leads us to truth, justice, and the American way.
The American vegan way.
The American vegan way, right.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think when animals are abused, it's either out of generally neglect, ignorance, but unfortunately there is a huge profit motive. And, you know, in this particular industry, the largest factor contributing to worker injuries is the speed at which animals are killed and processed.
And we just heard that the USDA wants to speed up those lines for chickens.
I know. It's quite remarkable. I mean, this is the meat industry is generally one where profit margins are very slim and volume is everything. So the workers are pressured endlessly to kill more animals in less time. And rather than regulating the line speeds for the interest of worker safety, line speed is limited only by federal sanitation laws. So the USDA at this point is not that interested in the welfare of the animals or the welfare of the worker,
right,
but only whether they can produce a lot of clean meat.
Now, one thing that's great about this story, and I really enjoyed it, as I mentioned to you earlier, I was flying to Minnesota, and I read it on the flight over, and it was the perfect timing. I started and finished for that flight. It was great entertainment. But the story, it's something that gives us insight into this industry where more and more we have less opportunity to know anything about this industry. There are more laws today that are protecting them so that people can't get inside, people can't see what's really going on, and there are numerous people now risking their lives to do undercover work and get film and footage to show, at the very least, that these companies are not obeying the few regulations that we have for these industries.
Oh, that's very true. You know, some states, not New York, thankfully, but states have what's called ag gag laws pending. Many states have passed them that makes it an actual crime for an investigator to go in and uncover what is really going on. So, it's a very difficult system that we've got in place, and many of the state legislatures are not helping things. They would like to, in fact, keep what goes on there hidden, secret, because exposing it is going to affect their bottom line.
Yeah, that's something I don't understand, and I continually ask myself, how do people do that sort of thing? And I just wonder, do we have just completely different DNA?
Yeah.
I don't understand some humans on this planet, and I know that I'm a part of the group, but I just don't understand why some think the way they do. Now, you have some names. For example, the evil corporation that you're writing about is Marshfield.
Yes.
Now, it has a similar ring to it to another company that is a major pork producer.
It does, but I must remind you that all names and characters are fictional in this narrative.
But you did talk about the wife of the guy that worked at Marshfield, that she worked at Walmart.
Yes.
So we have some real names in there, because Walmart wasn't really presented in any way, positive or negative, really.
No.
Yeah. That's another book.
That's another book.
Oh, okay. Well, I really enjoyed it. I think this is a book that people would enjoy reading. I use that word kind of loosely because it's uncomfortable reading, especially when we realize there's a lot of truth to it. But it moves very quickly, and it's very suspenseful and exciting. And who's got the movie rights?
Well, I still have the movie rights, but if anyone is interested, contact me through my website. You know, I mean, it's interesting because several people have come to me and asked about the movie making of something like this. Certainly, mm-hmm. You know, an HBO series or something like that about an animal rights investigator. You know, the big problem would be in the filming. You can't hurt animals. In the making of an animal welfare movie. So I figured, you know, shooting with animals, I've been an actress, I've done a couple of movies. Shooting, you know, a movie with animals is very, very complex and difficult. Because
right.
You don't want them to get hurt.
Right, especially a film like this.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah,
indeed.
Maybe it needs to be an animated film.
Well, animated, I mean, you know, there's a lot they can do digitally. But there's certainly no shortage of undercover video that can be used to supplement.
Right. Now, you mentioned that a few years ago your eyes were open, the veil was lifted. I don't know how many metaphors I can provide for you about what's going on with food and animals today. Was there anything particular that opened your eyes, a book you read or a movie or something or someone?
Yeah, I think two things. I mean, you know, for many people, I think understanding what's happening to animals and factory farms and slaughterhouses is an instantaneous recognition. For me, it was a little bit slower. My husband has been a vegetarian for 40 years.
Oh, okay.
And a vegan for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years. And he kind of opened my eyes to this. And was very patient and just talked to me about it. And, you know, slowly but surely, the more I started to give up meat, the more I was willing to actually look and see where it came from. And I think that's, you know, those two things go hand in hand, that often people who are defensive and they think to themselves, I could not live without meat and dairy.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to see where it comes from. But I think when you start to let go of the actual consumption of those products, it makes it easier to look at. So I did, and then I read Gail Eisenhut's book, Slaughterhouse, and after that I said, I'm done. No more meat, no more dairy, no more animal food.
I'm always curious what everyone's individual story is, because in my work, I'm trying to change everybody. And it's really challenging to get through.
It is.
Get through to people.
It is, you know. I mean, and I think we all have stories about, you know, being vegan and even having our own families and loved ones look at us like we're part of a cult.
Mm-hmm. We certainly sound like it.
Yes, and that's difficult. Because some people just not receptive to hearing about it.
Now, this first book, The Chain, is part of what you're calling the Kinship series.
Yes. Well,
does that mean there's going to be more of these books?
There are. In fact, I'm working hard on the second book, which takes my protagonist, Jude Brannick, the investigator, out to the Rockies, the Northern Rockies, where she finds herself caught between the ranchers and hunters and the conservationists and the controversy over wolves and trapping and hunting.
And how do you get to know these characters? Do you know people that would fill them, the ranchers and the hunters?
Well, for The Chain, you know, I talked to several undercover investigators who've been working there and got their feedback. I mean, I am a novelist, so mm-hmm. I tend to create my characters. But it's very important to me in this series that while the characters and the individual situations may be fictional, the underlying truth of what is happening to animals be very real. So I'm doing a lot of research, talking to a lot of people from Fish and Game and various parts of the ranching, hunting, conservationist community to try to learn as much as I can.
Do you let them know what you're doing with the information?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yes, yes.
What's their response?
Well, for the most part, I'm reaching out to people who are going to be sympathetic to my point of view. So, no, I'm not calling up any trappers and saying, you know, how does it feel to be a trapper?
Yeah, I just wish I could understand that. Oh, well.
Yes, oh, well.
Okay, well, very, very good. I really, really, really enjoyed this book, and I want it. How do we get it into the hands of the Senate, for example?
Well, we could send them copies.
There you go. Because as I mentioned before, Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, it's a different book, but it's about early industry here in this country and immigrants who came to the country and they were working in slaughterhouses.
Yeah.
And the conditions were filthy. The people were really impoverished and taken advantage of. And when this book came out, people were outraged. They were outraged at how the people were treated. I was reading it and going, what about these animals? But it did improve a lot of the regulation with our meat processing industry at the time.
It did. You know, I don't know to what extent that came directly from the legislature, or it came from the readers' perceptions and
readers. Yeah, I'm not sure, but my memory is saying I think a lot of people were outraged when they read it, and that started the ball rolling. So I hope we get another ball rolling, because we need a serious infusion of change.
I absolutely agree with you. And, you know, one of my goals is hopefully to get the book into the hands of people who just want a good story. And I know a lot of people won't pick up a nonfiction book about the meatpacking industry or factory farms.
Exactly.
But they might well pick up a book that's a good suspense read and hopefully allow themselves to be taken into this brand new world. And
you know, this I'm realizing this is a really good point, because I read these books all the time, the nonfiction ones,
mm-hmm.
and there are only a handful of them that are really good. And they're the power of a story is tremendous. And I'm thinking a lot of these books that some of us animal rights activists and vegan people like because we want this message to be heard. Nobody wants to read them. They're not interesting. And
yeah,
that's okay. Where a story like this, it really pulls people in, and whether they want to know it or about it or not, they're sucked in with a good story.
Well,
I like it.
Thanks. I mean, no, I think stories are incredibly powerful. You know, you look at the videos that go viral about animals,
mm-hmm.
and they're usually stories of rescue and heroics, and people like to be drawn in to a narrative where animals come out, you know, not the victims at the end.
Okay, just one more question, a little bit about you. When we opened, I briefly talked about your bio, and you've gone from one incredible career to the next. And how does that happen? Why did you move from one to the next? You were on Broadway, then you were a private investigator, then you were a lawyer.
Yeah,
they're all big.
Yeah, it sounds a little schizophrenic, but it actually had much more of an organic flow to it. I did start my career as an actress, but when work got slow after a while, a friend of mine said, I know this ex-actor who runs a private investigations agency, and he's always looking for actors to do undercover work because it's street theater.
Mm-hmm.
And he thinks actors do a better job.
Wow.
So I began with him. And
and actors make good lawyers, too.
Well actors, you know, there is a positive to having taken some acting classes. You know, there are many times standing in front of a judge when my knees were shaking, and I thought, I'm on shaky legal ground here, but I have to act confident. So... you know, that helps also.
Right. Well, fascinating. Anyway, I look forward to meeting you very soon in person.
Yes.
And sharing a green juice or something.
That would be wonderful.
But let's wait for it to warm up a bit.
At least for the snow to clear.
Yeah. Okay, Robin, great luck with this book, The Chain, and all your future books. Thank you for joining me today.
It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Okay. Ciao.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. We have a few minutes before we go to a break. And I wanted to talk a little bit about water. So it's snowing, and we're seeing all this snow come down, which is really water in one form, right? And we're hearing about droughts in California and other places. Water is so precious. I was, as I mentioned before, I traveled to Minnesota last week, and one thing that happens when I'm traveling, I don't find so much trouble eating, but when it comes to water, that's the difficult part, because when I'm at home, I distill my water, and I make sure I have a lot of it, and I've gotten to the point where I really cannot drink tap water unless it's been seriously cleaned. And this was the case when I was in Minnesota, eating in restaurants or wherever, and it kind of forces you to have to buy bottled water. And there are so many issues with bottled water today, just the fact that it takes so much water to manufacture those bottles, to put the water in, it's very, very wasteful. And then consuming water that's got the effects of plastic leaching into the water. Anyway, I survived, but I want to remind you, if you're interested in clean water, you can give me an email at info@realmeals.org. I'd be happy to have a conversation about it. I am very excited about one company that makes water distillers here in the United States, Aquanee. You can find out more about them at my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. I really enjoy promoting businesses here in the United States that are making excellent quality products. All right, why don't we take a quick little break, and then we're going to be back to talk about food and sustainability with Dr. Richard Openlander. We'll be back in a minute. everybody. I'm back. It's time for the second part of It's All About Food here on January 21st, 2014. How are you doing? And as I mentioned before, send me an email at info@realmeals.org about anything. I'd love to hear from you. Let me know what you're thinking, especially when it has to do with food. Okay. Let's move on because we have some very serious things to talk about. And I am going to do that with my next guest who has written a pretty incredible book. Dr. Richard Openlander is a consultant, researcher, and author whose award-winning book, Comfortably Unaware, has been endorsed as a must-read by Ellen DeGeneres, Dr. Jane Goodall, and Neil Barnard, among many others. He is a much-sought-after lecturer on the topic of food choice and how it relates to sustainability, all within the framework of fresh perspectives and critical insights. He's been a keynote speaker for several conferences and festivals and has presented lectures and workshops at numerous universities and corporations. He also serves as an advisor to municipalities in the U.S. and to a number of World Hunger projects that are designing programs from his multidimensional model of sustainability. He has spent 40 years studying the effects of food choices have on our planet and on us. He started an organic vegan food production company, operates an animal rescue sanctuary, and is the founder and president of the nonprofit organization Inspire Awareness Now. Welcome to It's All About Food, Dr. Openlander.
Well, hi, Karen. Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. I want to take just a moment to thank you for your work over the years in spreading awareness.
Thank you.
It's always encouraging.
You know, every time I talk to another incredible vegan that's doing great work, I keep thinking maybe it's this food that's powering us to be able to do all the different things that we do. You've got an incredible little resume going on here. What don't you do?
Well, I haven't changed everybody in the world to eat the most healthy, peaceful food yet.
So. We have a lot of work to do, don't we?
We do.
Okay, you wrote this book, Food Choice and Sustainability. I imagine you spent many years on this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have actually. I mean, it's the precursor was my first book, Comfortably Unaware, as you know. But this one is sort of a compilation of everything, and I think more importantly, it's timed very, very properly, because it's, as you know also, that the word sustainability has been frequently misused, if not abused, and it rarely, if ever, positions food choice, and it never positions the choice of raising and eating and slaughtering animals in any sustainability projects or efforts that I'm aware of, and this is why I wrote the book, essentially.
You almost make it sound like the word sustainability is a bad word.
Well, it's a great word if it's defined correctly, and I guess that's the whole role of the book, is that we need to incorporate food choice, specifically the raising and eating of animals, into sustainability efforts, or then we will never reach true sustainability. Now, the devastation that's taking place right now as we speak is jeopardizing not just, you know, the animals or individual human health, it's jeopardizing our survival as a species. And if that seems a little dramatic, then that also becomes part of the problem, because we just don't want to hear about it, which is one of the reasons we're in trouble and why I wrote the book, because the story needs to be told, and it needs to be told through an unfiltered lens.
It is a dramatic story, and we all need to be doing something yesterday, and we're not. And then the question is, are we going to be able to get this information out in time? You know, the earth will take care of herself.
Yes.
But whether we're on it is another question.
Well, that is the question, isn't it? It's sort of the Gaia theory that's exploding on us, because, right, species have the tendency to adapt and make its own environment and integrated in somewhat of a symbiotic way, whether we're here or not. And I think that's the issue that we're confronted with. But until we understand the devastation first that's taking place, and then recognize that we have to do something about it, and then what we have to do about it, then it's also, there's a timeline issue. There's a series of disconnects here, and you sort of sum them up in the way you just stated that, because the final disconnect is actually
game
over. Extremely important. With we're in overshoot mode right now. We're taking from and doing more to our planet than what it can sustain. Almost, it would almost take two Earths to sustain what we're currently taking from and doing to it. And most of that's because of our choice of foods.
Okay, this is an intense book. It's over 400 pages, small print. There's a lot of information in here, and it's a great reference and resource for anybody who wants to get all of this information out there. But let's start the way you start in the beginning. We'll touch on a couple of topics here in our short time together.
Sure.
And climate change. So this past weekend, we had a little article in the New York Times Sunday Review, Nicholas Kristof's column. I like to read his from time to time. I don't know if you read him, but he sounds like he's somebody that I think we can manipulate a little bit. It sounds like he's learning a little bit more than he wants to know about animal agriculture, but he doesn't talk about it in this column. He talks about how it seems like there's very little discussion about climate change in the media, and that 77% of humans seem to be more believing that aliens have visited the Earth versus 44% that believe that humans are causing climate change.
Mm-hmm.
So we have some serious problems there, and nobody is talking about how food can make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Well, right. So you just hit on a number of different disconnects, haven't you? And that article, I think, actually, if you not only read through it very well, but also take a step back from it, it actually displays our ultimate disconnect, which is that the climate change is happening. I mean, all scientists will tell you that. There are a few people who don't believe it, but it is happening. But the most important aspect of that is that what we can do about it, the anthropogenic greenhouse gases, the human-induced greenhouse gases that are being created, will be somewhere between 30 minimally and 51% are caused or derived from livestock. And there have been at least four different researchers independent of each other that have quantified those and explained them and documented them. So the issue is that and you're exactly right, we don't have nearly enough time to expound on all this, but I do in my book. But I can summarize by saying that each year our leading policymakers and governmental officials and nonprofit organizations and researchers meet in the climate change conferences supported by the United Nations, and agriculture, actually the umbrella of topic, is postponed until next year, and it's postponed just about every year. And livestock is never, the raising or eating of animals and their contribution is never discussed. And yet, again, up to 51% of all greenhouse gases that we produce are caused by livestock, and that doesn't include our demand, the greenhouse gases, because of our demand to eat fish, you know, the refrigeration, fuel, processing, transportation, et cetera. So it's a very large issue, and the larger issue is, I think, why? You know, why aren't the organizations mentioning that? And I have a lot of those type of answers and theories and perspectives in my book as well.
That's the big question. Why? Well, I'm very aware of the numbers you're mentioning. The 51% of human-induced greenhouse gases was put forth by Jeff Hanhang and Robert Goodlin, who unfortunately just passed away in December.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We miss you, Robert.
That's right.
And but there are some other people out there, like Frank Mitlohner, who debates against this and says that livestock can actually improve climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, he's been hired by the USDA to work with them on this.
Well, Karen, yeah, okay, so a couple of things about that. One is also Alan Savory, you know, that's been on TED Talks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I wrote a nice review of that that people can find online now. But basically, here's where we are. Livestock now occupy 45% of the entire landmass on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
They're also the most destructive force for our rainforests, which are being destroyed in the Amazon area, at least up to 90% of all the loss of the Amazon since 1970 has been due to livestock and crops to feed them. Well, the issue is this. The reason that it's so difficult for them to address this correctly or to suppress it or, you know, shove it under the rug a little bit is because of a couple reasons. One is that it's so that is so culturally ingrained, they themselves most likely consume animal products. So how we expect our leaders to change if they themselves are doing something that, you know, they can't change for themselves? Secondly is that they're afraid. They're very much afraid of losing their audience or their platform, because 98% of the rest of the people in the world consume animal products. So they feel as if they're going to lose their platform, even if they were very much aware of all these stats and figures and took it seriously. So They're also very, very concerned about the powerful meat, dairy, and fishing industries, which control $1 to $2 trillion worth of goods and policies and policies meaning subsidies, as well as their budget for marketing. So it's a very large scaled problem that we have on all those levels.
The thing about climate change that's especially scary, and we're going to talk about some of the other things in your book, is that it seems like once we're really into the significant warming of the Earth, there's no turning around.
Right. Well, what you're talking about are tipping points.
Yes.
Right. And it's very well established by the International Energy Agency and most of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change. They all agree that we only have a 3-year window of time from now,
mm-hmm.
actually, to drastically reduce
mm-hmm.
them. And so that's the whole issue. And if you look at it carefully, the easiest thing we can do is just stop eating animals. If you're looking at how to change it in terms of, for instance, most of the money that's being devoted or set aside now by the United Nations is going to renewable energy, but it's projected by most experts to take at least 20 years and another $18 trillion to develop. And obviously, if we have a tipping point in 3 years, I mean, just do the math, and we don't have 20 years to wait, and we also don't have $18 trillion. So, you know, the easiest solution is just to do what is obvious and take away, reduce, or eliminate the 51% due to livestock.
It sounds so sweet and so simple.
Well, it is.
So here's just one more climate question.
Sure.
And I don't know that you have the answer, but, you know, Earth has a long history. And we know through all kinds of evidence that the climate has changed dramatically every 100,000 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we know that the climate is really going to be affected by what we do? I mean, I know that we've seen more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but, you know, the Earth and nature is so powerful. How do we even think that we can have such a big impact?
Well, right. Well, so you're asking a very, very large scientific question, and I can answer part of that by saying that, yes, there are fluctuations. Anybody who's studied those will attest to that. I think the issue at hand, Karen, isn't so much that we are causing entirely the every single effect you see. I think the larger question, the overriding question here is that what effect do we have on greenhouse gases that are then contributing to climate change? It's sort of intrinsically related in a linear pattern. Like, for instance, you look at almost all scientists involved and climatologists that are involved in anything to do with our history of our planet and climate will agree that we are going through a period of time where climate change is accelerating faster than any other time that we know of, certainly in our history. And they also agree that human-induced greenhouse gas emissions are heavily contributing to that. So therefore, we have a choice. I mean, we have a choice to just let it go and continue on, or we have a choice to reduce those things that we have the ability to reduce. I mean, we may not be able to reduce many of the other aspects of greenhouse gas emissions, for instance, non-anthropogenic methane production by various faults and things like that, but we mm-hmm. certainly can do something about our habits and our choices.
You know, we don't hear this enough, and the real problem are humans on the Earth. I mean, if we weren't here, I don't think we'd be seeing all of these
problems.
That's right.
Well, you know, another good example, I don't know if you're going to get onto this or move on to this topic right now, but, I mean, just to give you an example, which I think it segues pretty nicely, is that our oceans are being destroyed, and our oceans are one of the moderators of mm-hmm. our climate, obviously. They're the ones that drive our climate. And our oceans right now are becoming more acidic and they're warmer, more acidic, and they have deoxygenation occurring faster than any other time that we've seen in the last 300 million years. And at that time, I think most researchers felt that somewhere around 95% of all oceanic life became extinct. And it took 30 million years to recover.
Wow.
And most of the drivers for that warming and acidification can be directly related to the greenhouse gases that we're producing. So with 30 to 51% are being produced by our food choices on land, and then at the same time the oceans are becoming acidified by the carbon dioxide, and at the same time that's happening, we're completely depleting all the life by fishing and by the types of destructive methods that we're using by fishing. I mean, 85% of all fish have been depleted or overexploited. So if we're doing that, those are our choices, Karen. They're not something that just the world happens to, the Earth happened to have, has changed and evolved. We're actually devolving, you know, because of our choices, if that's the right term. But, you know, I mean, we're going backwards, and it's seriously affecting the Earth in many, many ways. Those are just a couple. I mean, climate change and our oceans. But, I mean, we're also depleting our fresh water.
You talk a lot about a lot of things in this book, and the oceans and the fish and the extinction of a lot of species of fish.
Yeah.
And yet people are continually getting the message to eat more fish. And
yes.
Half of the fish today is farmed.
Right. Right, that's right. Well, there are a couple issues with that.
Big issues.
Yeah. One is, you're right, the USDA came out about 2 years ago, in 2012, suggesting that Americans double their intake of fish. And what that's going to do is actually going to just create more depletion and obviously, and more devastation because of the fishing methods, but also it's the targeted fish are being depleted. No matter whether they're titled sustainable or not, there's really no such thing as sustainable commercial fishing right now, regardless of whether MSC or, you know, the Marine Stewardship Council or anybody else puts a label on it. And there are many reasons for that that I expound on in my book, but also because of the devastating effects of, or the damages to various intertwining ecosystems that are actually infinite in quantity. And we haven't really, you know, there's no human that can calculate that equation of infinity in the oceans. We just go in and pluck things out and then hope that somehow they're going to recover, but they're not. And so, and you mentioned other species. I mean, that's just in our oceans, but you know, it's been estimated that somewhere between 1,000 and 10,000 times the amount of species that are going extinct per year that we've had for the previous several thousands of years.
I know a lot of people are eating more fish because they're encouraged to, and there are many of my listeners that are very knowledgeable about the food system, but still believe fish is an important food.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, people need to understand how we're getting fish today. You know, it's not, you know, a couple of rugged, ruddy fishermen in a boat and a line. It's obscene what's happening. And you mentioned the word infinity as if the ocean was infinite, and it's not.
That's right.
Can you talk about trawlers and the nightmare that's going on in our oceans?
Well, right. There are really a couple different ways that our oceans are being destroyed. And I mentioned one of them initially, which we can't, in any frank discussions about depletion of our oceans, really have to begin with land-based animal agriculture, which we just highlighted, but because that's what's causing some of the greenhouse gas emissions that are causing the devastation in the type of water that we have in our oceans. But in terms of life, yes, it's affecting our oceans and sea life in a number of ways. The first is, of course, the target fish. We go after massive amounts of target fish with various methods, from trawling, both bottom trawling, which many have heard about as being destructive, but there's also middle-level trawling, and there's also long-line fishing, which causes serious issues. There's piscine, which just scoops up every single living thing within a mile radius. Some long-line fishing methods extend a long line the length of between 30 and sometimes 100 miles behind a boat, and they catch every single thing that's even swimming near that.
I can't imagine it.
No, I mean, to give you an example, there's a swordfish fishery in Canada that was labeled sustainable just a year and a half ago by MSC, and yet for every 20,000 swordfish they catch and kill 100,000 sharks, and they also catch and kill about 1,000 to 2,000 loggerhead and leatherback turtles that are nearly extinct. And yet the fishery was labeled sustainable. And that's the way it is with most fisheries. You know, they just do so much damage to the target fish themselves, but also collateral damage of bycatch and then also destroying ecosystems that depend on that. For instance, krill. You know, we're taking krill at the rate of about 1.5 million tons per year from the Antarctic, and yet baleen whales such as blue right and fin and all the species of seals and many other sea life depend on that krill for their life. So, you know, and there are other ways, I guess, getting back to what you said there, we don't have nearly enough time to discuss all the human aspects, but there are so many more, and you know this, more beneficial ways to get more, so much healthier ways to derive health benefits from other food sources than from fish.
And then there's our government.
of course.
Which seems to, like, move slower than anything out there and is the last to discover what's important. We like to think that we have a safe food system, that we have a regulated food system that protects us and brings the best to us. And even these certifications that you were just mentioning that you go into great detail in your book, these different certifications by companies that tell us which fish we can eat and which we can't, and they're not even telling the truth.
Right.
How do people know what to do?
Well,
who do we
okay.
trust?
So let's separate out what you're asking. I mean, in sort of an overarching way, I can say that you're exactly right, that our government, much of this could be in the hands of the government, but you're asking policymakers that are stumbling over so many different things, and they're biased in so many different ways. So the most important, and by the way, our food bill still hasn't been established from 2012, and there's been so much time and effort and money tied into that, but they are really operating under the wrong pretense as well and under the wrong definitions. They're not defining sustainable well at all either, or healthy food, and that's something that I expound on quite a bit in the book as well. But to answer it a little bit better, I think the easiest thing to do is to just first of all start understanding more about the benefits of purely plant-based food. And I'm not talking about taking a few little baby steps here and there. I'm talking about, you know, for every bite of food that you eat that's plant-based, you're going to be saving lives, and you're going to be saving our planet's life. And you may end up eventually. I mean, in the most recent lectures I give, I sort of ask everybody to consider being superheroes or heroes with every single thing they eat, because that's exactly what we're doing. We're most likely collectively, if we all do this, we're going to be saving our own species, let alone every other species on Earth. And so that's the first step, is understand that, and then look for those type of food items. And because no matter what the government says, if you understand that the basis of healthy eating really comes from healthy production, agricultural production, and what resources, what very, very finite and few resources we have to produce this with, for a burgeoning population of expected to be over 9 billion people by the year 2050. So as we go along, we're going to have to find the most resource efficient foods, what I call it, finding the most optimal relative sustainability. You know, the ones that you can produce with the least amount of resources that will affect our health in the most optimal way, and create the least amount of greenhouse gases or effect on climate change, and be the most compassionate. So we start looking at what food is that I can put in my mouth that I can have grown, especially in a collective manner, globally, that fits that, then it has to be plant-based, because it's just extremely inefficient, not to mention not being compassionate or all these other, unhealthy for our own human health to eat these animal-based products. So I think that's the first step. No matter what the government is going to be telling you, you know, we have to start finding solutions on our own, and then eventually the government will have these tasks in front of them, either by a collective movement, or they'll be realizing where all of our fresh water is going and where all of our land's going and why our health care costs are so high in our country. It's going to hit sooner or later, and then they'll have to make changes.
You mentioned fresh water, and you talked more before about sustainability, and we have, let's just mention our aquifers for a moment. We have farmers all over the country and in other countries actually draining at alarming rates these aquifers that contain incredibly beautiful fresh water that was created in the Ice Age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 15 million years ago. I mean, that's such a large problem. Now, I first want to point out that most people, in an argumentative mode, would say, well, the water's all constant on Earth, and that's true. Water as an entity is constant, but the consumptive form that it happens to be in is not. In fact, it's projected that in just 14 years, there'll be a 40% shortage in fresh water, and that's because of how it's being used right now. And about 29% of all fresh water withdrawals in the world go to livestock. And it's terribly inefficient, and it may require 100 to 400 times the amount of water to produce a pound of meat as it would for a pound of much higher nutritional value of plant-based foods. And you're right about the aquifers. Typically in the United States, I mean, there are quite a few, but a couple that come to mind are the Ogallala that provide water, fresh water, as you said, it was actually created back in the Ice Age, back in the 15 million years ago or so. And we also have the San Joaquin. We have other areas. There's some areas in North China Plain that are being drawn down at an alarming rate. And they're typically all, on average, being drawn down at a rate between 3 and 7 times their recharge rate. So that means that you can just calculate out very, very, very quickly that we will be, I mean, if you knew the amount in terms of volume of these aquifers, that we're going to be out of those aquifers, especially the Ogallala, most likely in the next 15 to 20 years.
It's going to be very interesting the next few years.
Mm-hmm. It will be.
Yeah, it will be. We have this climate change tipping point predicted for 3 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
Although some people had predicted 2010, and now we're at 2017, and God, I hope we can push it out further, because I don't see much happening in 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to see it. How do you feel?
Well, of course, the reason I'm even talking to you right now, or that I've written the book, yes, I'm very optimistic. Otherwise, I'd probably crawl up in my own little sustainable fragment of the world and do everything that I know is right. And, I feel sorry for everybody else. But, the thing is about sustainability is that we all are in it together. And I don't know that not only is there a disconnect between, what we don't know about our unsustainable habits and then how it's related to the animal agriculture and our food choices, but we also don't really have a good feel that we have to all go on this ship together. Most of the people in the world and most organizations and policymakers are on this very large ship that are trying to get this sustainability, but they're going in a different direction because food choice isn't properly positioned. So I'm circling this back around to what we started out with by saying that we all have to do the right thing together or none of us will make it. And the timelines now are very, very clear, and I think the reason you're hearing that it's been pushed out a little bit is because those researchers are being a little bit more optimistic that we can still change it around. But if you look at all of them collectively, it's the tipping points in a number of areas are already gone. We're already past them. For instance, the 2,000 to 40,000 species that are going extinct each year, the tipping point's mm-hmm. obviously over for them.
Mm-hmm.
The tipping point for most of the fish in our oceans is over. I'm talking about our lifetime and future generations from now that we can somewhat see in the distance. As you said, I mean, if you apply anything at all about, the Gaia theory or something, we're remote to that, is that, sure, there'll be other species inhabiting the Earth, but it may not be humans.
Okay, we just have a few minutes, and I have one last quick question. And you traveled a lot around to collect information for this book, and I imagine you visited some farms. Did you talk to meat producers or animal product producers and share with them your thoughts on how you thought we need to eat more plants and less of what they were producing?
Oh, I do. Well, let's quickly look at a couple things you just said. I have visited maybe 300, 400 farms all over the world, especially the ones recently that have been promoted as the most sustainable, using that word again. So I, of course, would hop on the flight and go to see why they're the most sustainable, and they're not. And so not only did I record the reasons that they're not sustainable, because they all involve a much higher level of inefficiency than if they just changed it entirely over to plant-based systems. But the second thing is that I will always talk to them about it, but it's on the exit, because otherwise I would be probably dismissed from their farm earlier, because
mm-hmm.
they're all under the belief that they're doing something sustainable. The ones, if you really talk to the grass-fed operators, they'll tell you that factory farms are still going to be needed. And that's a whole other topic.
Mm-hmm.
But they all feel that animal agriculture will be sustainable. They just, when you really nail them down and talk about the numbers, they'll tell you that parts or portions of their animal agriculture are not sustainable. But as a whole, we have to find ways to make sure that they just move their operations over into certainly a much higher level of sustainability by transferring all their animal-based agriculture into plant-based. And that includes in developing countries. It's a very large topic, and that we don't have time to cover now. But, isn't that a shame that, most of their land has been eroded and destroyed because of their pastoral methods with cattle. And we just need to kind of do this globally, and we'd solve a lot of problems.
Okay, well, thank you, Dr. Richard Openlander, for writing this book. And I wish I could do some kind of Vulcan mind meld where everybody get this information instantly, but we have a lot of work to do.
We do. I just thank you very much for the opportunity, Karen, and for all you're doing. And let's keep moving things forward and with a smile on our face. And the most important thing is to keep inspiring others to become aware.
That's right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, we've come to the end of the program, and I just want to wish you a very good week and a delicious one. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food, and we'll be back next week. Bye.